Greetings, you happily miserable accursed. Hurley here with your ever-loving political panel. Scott Reed, Corey Tenike, and Jordan Leichnitz. Look, I want to start the pod today by asking the three of you, Jesus, Murphy, to virtually put your arms around each other's shoulders, bring it in tight, and huddle up with me as I appeal to the spirit of Ronnie Lancaster to help the Saskatchewan Rough Riders. Little General, David Hurley here, of the Prelate Hurleys. You probably remember my brother Vern. You remember me. I was the rather boisterous 13-year-old in the rider rookie section in Taylor Field in 1975, double-fisting hot dogs and Coca-Cola, cheering on you and Rhett Dawson. I haven't called on you before, but it's bad, Ronnie, it's bad. We're down to our third or fourth QB here, man, so I have a favor to ask of you. Could you imbue whoever lines up behind center this week with some of your special Lancaster juju? You know, just sprinkle some leadership, some talent, some smarts on them. Thanks, Ronnie. You're the best. Oh, and I don't blame you at all for the 76 Grey Cup. That was totally Ted Provost's fault. All right, that ought to work. I know you feel my pain on this, Corey.
Yes.
Saskatchewan's in mourning. Anyway, here's the rundown this week. We're going to talk about the Ontario by-elections and their implications, if any. Our cursed clipping is from Reza Patel, Alex Ballingall, and Stephanie Levitz, writing in The Star on high level of grumbling in the Liberal caucus. That'll kick off our cabinet shuffle discussion. And then I want to dive into housing, specifically what Sean Fraser's role is going to be, whether anybody can find a way to use this potent issue politically. And after that, Gordon Pinsent and our Hey Yous. Corey, Jordan, Scott, you know what's happened since the last time I saw you? I'm wearing these cheap reading glasses because I have a cataract on my left eye. So now I have to wear these so that I can see through my right eye until I get my cataract removed.
Really? Cataracts, eh?
Yeah.
Cataracts.
Not the cataracts, but the glasses.
Cataracts. So, and how's your hip? That's going to go next, and soon we won't be allowed to leave you in the kitchen with the stove on. You're really, this is it, Hurley.
My hip isn't bothering me yet, but I've put myself on a list so that by the time it is, by the time it is gone, that I'm somewhere on a list. How was your guys' weekend?
Good.
All right. Yeah. It was all right. I was supposed to be canoe camping, but my kids got sick, so I was not canoe camping.
Those kids weren't sick. They were faking. They were mom wants to go camping. I feel a pain in my side.
There's no screens. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
They didn't seem too put out, oddly.
Well, right, I was hanging out in Niagara Falls. Make a plug for Niagara Falls. It was actually a great time and a ton of tourists.
I'm going to take my great nieces there at the end of August. What's the thing to do other than Maid of the Mist?
I took the kids to the water park. That's fun. You know, all that kind of kid stuff. Go to a haunted house. It's like all that kitschy kind of stuff, but it's fun. You know, it's actually a great place to take kids that age.
UFO restaurant. That's the number one destination, the UFO restaurant.
Definitely Wax Museum.
Yeah. Scott, I'm going to continue to tell you that Commander Hadfield told me definitively there are no UFOs.
Well, what would he know? Do you remember the time we were in London and I dragged you to a wax museum, David? You were so angry.
London, England.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was great. And we saw wax Bruce Springsteen come out of the floor playing Born in the USA. Hurley was like, I'm fucking out of here. I'm out of here.
So hysterically bad. Madame Tussauds rock museum show. Oh my God! What were we doing there?
The name of the game in Niagara, guys.
London, England.
This London, England.
Yeah,
London.
I don't know why spent you guys 40 are minutes doing there. On there that. There was definitively other things to do in London, England.
Then we went to Brown, and we went to tea at Brown's Hotel, and got overheard talking about the bank mergers by a woman from the Bank of Montreal. You're like, Christ, this planet is tiny.
Yeah, there might have been more political considerations in that conversation than we would have preferred a banker to hear.
It might have been what would be termed indiscreet conversation, but I didn't think anyone sitting, you know, with a tray full of little teeny cakes would be thinking about Canadian domestic politics.
I think Roy McLaren had put a tail on us.
That was likely it.
Yeah. All right. So there were two Ontario by-elections last week. Both of them won by the Liberals. One of them was a hold. One of them was a pickup. The Liberals are celebrating their apparent survival, as am I. John Fraser says, we're back, baby. The NDP.
Not quite.
The NDP finished.
Like what? Sort of resurrection, maybe.
Yeah. You don't want me to get to the NDP part. The NDP finished third in both, but they like the fact that they grew their vote. The federal conservatives are taking credit for Ford's losses, saying they deliberately didn't help. Weird times. Scott, what do voters like about this leaderless Liberal Party?
I think it starts with the leaderless part. I think they're all jacked for that. I think two things. It's always important not to overestimate these things, but, you know, we shouldn't blow it off.
No, if you're dead, you'd lose them. Like, what would we be saying if they'd lost them both?
Exactly. So I think that I you don't want to overestimate them, but don't give them short shrift either. And I think ultimately it's got to be about Ford. Like, I think there's got to be some hesitation around Ford. People are going, you know, like, at least we're not in the days.
He's up 17 points in the latest poll.
Yeah, I know. But this tells you that, you know, there's a little bit of buzz there. And so I think that's a helpful sign. I would be like, but not to be a rain cloud, because I do think I think there's lots of opportunity for the Liberals. This is why I've thought that, you know, the Ontario Liberal leader's job has been the best bet in politics for the past 5-6 years. I mean, I think, you know, you've got a cracking chance at being premier, you know, if you take that job on. So I think, you know,
that's good in anything other than a vest.
Exactly. In a weird sort of fishing vest in Vaughan. I don't know where that is. Anyway, but the other thing I would say that's a little less optimistic is that I don't think it's just NDP spin about the NDP growing their vote. And that does worry me. Like, I mean, if you look at these results, and again, they're by-elections and it's low voter turnout, particularly in Toronto, but the three parties are not that far apart, you know, in terms of the popular vote turnout. And I don't think that's a thing that the Liberal Party systemically can sustain. It has to be the undisputed opponent of Ford in order to really consolidate. Otherwise, in a general, they just get walked on past. Now, they've got a leadership race coming up. That's going to give them some attention. They can get some mojo going. So there's lots of stuff to work with there. But I didn't like how bunched up the parties were, because I think, you know, that gives Ford lots of opportunity for split scenarios going forward. And I think that it means for the Liberals, they got to keep a close eye on Marit Stiles, even though the quick and easy analysis was, oh, this is bad for Marit Stiles. But I didn't like how high that NDP vote was. I don't like people feeling like it's okay to vote for them in Kanata Carlton. That's not good for the Liberals long term.
Okay, Jordan, but seriously, right? Scott's point is well taken in that the progressive primary is not over, right? But that's really bad news for the NDP. I mean, they've had this official opposition position for 6 years now. The Liberals with no money, no presence in the House, nothing. Don't the NDP, and I'm being tendentious with you, I know, but don't the NDP have to start winning one of these things to put a stake in the heart of the Liberal Party? I mean, if you're going to be the challenge to the government, you've got to be the one winning the by-elections, not the third party.
Yeah, okay, well, sure, it's always better to win them than not. But I think that what we often talk about here is the enduring appeal of the Liberal brand in Ontario. And to be honest, you know, you joke with Scott about the leaderless Liberals, the leaderlessness being the important bit. But I actually think there's a bit to that as well, right? Like, literally, these were by-elections run on the Liberal brand. And so it's not entirely surprising to me that it remains strong, but I do think that the NDP numbers here are good for Marit overall. She is holding her own. These were not NDP seats, and they were extremely competitive. Like, Kanata Carlton, that's not something that would have been in play even 2 or 3 years ago, and it very much was. So I think that the news is not bad for Marit there. And they need to continue to put themselves out there as the opposition to Ford. And for me, what's really interesting about these by-elections is that, you know, I think the NDP numbers are encouraging for the party, but what's happening with the PCs, I think, is really the takeaway here. So they drove expectations really, really high about these by-elections. Ford put himself personally out there. His ministers were out there. They poured a lot into these, and they were not able to bring it home. And I think that, you know, there's obviously a bit of a soft underbelly there for either the Liberals and the New Democrats to go after. And I think that the case that is being made for people who don't feel comfortable voting for Ford is around in whose interests he's governing. So the Greenbelt stuff has not been helpful on this. The idea that he is rewarding his friends and his insiders. And it was Abacus had some numbers out on this last week, I think, where they said that, you know, 54% of Ontarians believe that Ford is governing in the interests of his friends and supporters, and less than 30% say in the interests of all Ontarians. So there's like a pathway in there, right? Despite Ford's really strong overall numbers,
we can, I wonder what people would say about any government on a question like that. I really
such a bullshit. Yeah. Such a bullshit.
Well, hold on. Corey will get his turn, but I think that the problem here is there's two problems for Ford. Is one, that he really put himself out here on these by-elections and was not able to bring it home. So that is never a good thing. If you were going to do that, you better have a clear prospect of victory. And the second thing is, a lot of these issues that are driving voters to the notion that he's rewarding insiders and his friends are own goals. These are his own policy decisions. These are his own moves. And so I think that there is definitely an issue there where he is reinforcing a narrative that maybe is actually more dangerous to him than was initially thought.
So, Corey, obviously I want to get your take on these by-elections. I mean, I have to say, as a preface to you, I've said this 100 times before in this show, I think it's extremely difficult for governments to win by-elections. And I don't find anything personally incongruous with the notion that you can be the choice to govern at 41% province-wide, but when people get a chance to kick you in the shins in a by-election, the people that want to kick you come out to vote, and the other people don't come out to vote, and that's what happens. This has always been my excuse when I lost them anyway. What's yours?
Well, I think that's partially true. Like I think
I like your excuse.
I'll borrow that.
But I think that was a lot of talking that I had to listen to, like a whole lot of bullshit about reading into something that is really, I think, not that big a surprise. Like what is Scarborough Guildwood? It's one of the safest Liberal seats in the province. It's been Liberal forever. Like since its formation, and you know, like you can look at it different ways if you want to, but basically, I don't think that's, you know, there was great news in Scarborough Guildwood for the Liberals. Like they got a victory by a tiny, tiny margin and an almost a perfect three-way split. That's not good news in Scarborough Guildwood for the Liberal Party. It's not good news at all. They need to have commanding wins in seats like that. Like, you know, this is one of the top eight seats in the province for them. And so any seat that the Conservatives didn't win in the last election is a tough seat, like it just inherently. Mm. And this is one of the tougher ones. So, you know, why is it that the Conservatives are competitive at all there? It's really because of Ford. Ford has more cachet in the 416 than any Conservative leader in my living memory, in terms of support levels in North York, Etobicoke, and Scarborough. And he wins seats in these areas, and they're not traditional areas for Conservatives to win. Kanata is a little more difficult. You know, that Kanata is more of a bellwether seat, tends to vote with whoever wins government. But, you know, federally, it's been Liberal since 2015. And the person who was running it for the Liberal Party there was a longtime MP and quite popular. Like, she'd won the seat in the past with over 50% of the vote. So it's, you know, good candidate, small voter turnout. Where is Ford sitting at in the polls right now? 41%, basically where he was on election day. I don't think there's any reason to be pulling the panic alarm here.
Well, I would say from the Liberals' perspective, it was really helpful. When they sit down with the banks to try to borrow some money for the next campaign, they're going to get more because they won these two by-elections than they would have got if they'd lost it. It's an important sign of momentum for them, I think.
Well, momentum, really. You know, do you know who doesn't need to go to have a big loan at the bank next time? It'll be the Conservatives because they ran a campaign cash positive. And there are a lot of challenges there. They're leaderless. Yes, that's a problem. I don't see anything that's a compelling, you know, we're you know, in it to win it and big growth. Like, you know, they won both of these seats with support in the low 30s. Like, that's not something that you'd be jumping up and down cheering about if it were any other party.
I know we spent more time talking about these by-elections than they merit. I know we spent more time talking about them than they merit as by-elections. So the only fundamental takeaway, obviously, is the Liberal Party ain't dead in Ontario. And that's important. Like, that's just an important thing. It's good for the Ontario Liberals. And it means something going forward.
The Liberal Party is never dead in Ontario. Like, we've had this conversation before. It has an enduring brand appeal. Like, and it should be sitting, you know, at 30 points at any given moment. And, you know, it has not for the last couple of election campaigns. It's been sitting in the 20s. But that's unusual. But there is an enduring brand appeal for the Liberal Party in Ontario, whether it's federally or provincially. And, like, they can be leaderless as long as you want, but they are the Jason Voorhees of political parties. You can chop them up into little pieces, but they're going to come back for a sequel. It's just always the way it is.
Well, and we'll see. Like, they've, you know, the New Democrats, playing spoiler here, they've turned two very safe Liberal and NDP ridings into tight three-way races. So that's going to be an interesting dynamic to watch.
By the way, I'd have a cash positive campaign as well if I said to every developer in the entire province, you can fucking pave over any corn stalk you like. It's go time.
Corey.
Yeah, because none of those people have ever given money to the Liberal Party. Never.
That's right.
Every single one of them.
No, they didn't give it to the Liberal Party. They gave it to the chief of staff to a minister who asked them.
I'm really here for the who is more corrupt. This is great.
We changed all that. We changed all that.
Looking real good. Looking good, David.
We've been reading about this news and seeing it, smelling it, breathing it in all summer long. 10 million hectares of our Canadian forests have burned in 2023. Even more sobering, that's a real-time statistic as wildfires continue to rage across the country. What's clear is that we are living through yesterday, today, and tomorrow a present and growing environmental emergency, one that results in biodiversity loss, health issues resulting from poor air quality, and massive CO2 emissions that further drive climate change, not to mention the economic impact. Annual fire protection costs are more than $1 billion a year. So here's a corresponding real-time investment TELUS's Pollinator Fund for Good announced just 4 days ago. Recall that Pollinator is TELUS's $100 million social impact fund, investing in startup companies where making the world a better place is baked into the business model. Dryad Networks is a German startup who've developed wireless interlinked gas sensors that, in combination with large-scale Internet of Things networks, detect wildfires in their earliest smoldering phase. As soon as trace amounts of gas are detected, the system sends alerts across the network within minutes, so first responders can get to the nascent fire before it spirals out of control. With the amount of forest burned by wildfire projected to double by 2050, TELUS's investment is going to dramatically accelerate the deployment of Dryad's technology. Right now, it's in Europe, South America, and parts of the US. Pollinator will help it scale further in the US and into Canada. The goal by 2030? 120 million of these sensors will protect 4 million hectares of forest around the world. Hurly Burlyites, it's always good to make a timely investment. But after what we've seen this and the last few summers, this one couldn't be more critical. Go to telus.com/pollinator to learn more. Corey, I got to stick with this on one more. And it is a bit of a stickly discussion point, but I think we should have it, which is I didn't make that stuff up about the division in the Conservatives. There was a senior Conservative wanting to be quoted on election night, saying that they had deliberately not helped and took credit for the loss. And that was unrebutted by anybody that I saw. So it feels like that rift is a little real. Conservatives can only win Ontario federally once in a blue moon when all the planets align. This looks like it could be one of those times. When Joe Clark lost to Pierre Trudeau in 1980, part of the reason was Trudeau swept Ontario, and it was pretty clear that Bill Davis preferred Trudeau to Clark, to Joe Clark. And that mattered. And he certainly didn't help him in any way, shape, or form with the big blue machine. And when Mulroney became conservative leader, one of his very top priorities was mending that rift. And he went and he met with Bill Davis and they developed a relationship. And he put a bunch of Davis's people in charge of his campaign, Norman Atkins and a bunch of people. And in the 1984 election, Bill Davis was on the hustings stumping for Brian Mulroney. As he swept Ontario. So that's kind of a little history thing. Doesn't a similar thing have to happen here, Corey? Two sides have to find a way to work together, don't they?
I don't think there's some big rift. Like I saw the tweet in question. I thought that somebody who probably shouldn't be drinking and tweeting more than anything else. Like I don't think it's a real thing. I think the federal conservative party is not, some institution that's going to deliver huge votes for you in Scarborough Guildwood, for instance. And, and conservatives did better in Canada, provincially, than they have federally. And I was out there door knocking. I saw lots of people who were federal conservatives out there door knocking. I don't think this rift exists in reality on the ground. I think people who support Doug Ford in Ontario largely support Pierre Poilievre. I think at a sort of retail, local riding association level, I think all of that is bullshit. I just don't think it's a real thing.
But don't you think that the org implications of it are important? Like it seems to be.
Like org implications,
in terms of the resources for organizers on the ground, like that.
Well, like illegally sharing voter data or something. Like what does that actually look like? In terms of IT infrastructure, you see sharing of some of that stuff in terms of voter tracking systems. I'm puzzled as to what you think that is. Like. It's local volunteers that go out and campaign for one party, do for the other. And I don't think it's dramatically different than what you see with the NDP or with the Liberals.
I hear you, Corey, and I understand exactly what you're saying. And I think you make a number of compelling points unto themselves. And I think you're utterly full of shit. I think that it is incredibly important when the Conservative Party and the apparatus around Pierre Poilievre as the federal Conservative leader, They are declaring that they have a different template than Doug Ford, that they don't want to follow that template. And I think they want to be seen as not emulating the Ford template. I think they want to be seen as cutting their own path. And I don't know that it's going to have massive implications in terms of vote patterns going forward. And I don't know that it's going to mean that people who work on riding campaigns in suburban Toronto won't work for one or the other. I kind of doubt all that, but I just think it's important and notable and certainly not something that can just be dismissed with a wave of the hand that there's this sense, there's this tension, there's a we're going to win under our own steam and our own way, and it's not that way. And from the outside, it looks to me like Ford's a happy populist and Poilievre is an angry populist. I'm sure the people around Pierre Poilievre would reject that construction.
Angrily, I'm sure.
They would with great venom. But I just think it's interesting. It's goddamned interesting when there's these differences. I know that when there was tension between the McGuinty Liberals and the Martin Liberals, when we were in the Prime Minister's office and Dalton was in the Premier's office, it's something we get poo-pooed. We would poo-poo and we would say it's no big deal and we would say all of that. And the truth is that all those hardworking Liberals in the ridings worked for both federal and provincial parties, but it was a thing. It was a real thing. And I think it feels like something here is a thing.
Well, I think about two things. I think about the fact that Ford controls hundreds of exempt staff who can either be very vigorously involved in a federal campaign or not. And the second thing is that Ford, if he distances himself from Poilievre in the campaign, allows the Liberals to triangulate Poilievre into a more extreme position. If he allows the Trudeau to use himself as a centrist conservative figure as distinguished from Poilievre, I think that could be a big deal in Ontario too. I think the Poilievre people need Ford.
Well, they don't. I would agree with that. I think the polio people need forward far more than the other way around.
Like, I don't think they feel that way. Like, because, you know, what are those stories about? They're basically, you know, as unnamed federal conservatives saying, fuck you, Doug Ford, as loudly as they possibly can, and trying to draw.
I'm saying that's a mistake.
A distinction. Well, I think it's a mistake, too, because I think, you know, you're better to be trying to build a larger coalition than to be building a narrower one, and where you're alienating people who you know otherwise would be supportive. And you know, I don't think it makes a lot of sense. But I also think it's inherently true that everybody's got a slightly different voter coalition. You can't make a voter coalition if you're Pierre Poilievre that's identical to the Doug Ford one, because you're not Doug Ford. Like, you know, the Ford appeal, and you know, we were talking about earlier, you know, in the Scarboroughs and the Etobicokes and the North Yorks, is built on a foundation of that family name, and you know, decades of profile within those communities. So, like, he's going to have to do it a different way anyway. I'm always a little bit puzzled with the giant "fuck you" at the end of some of those statements from unnamed conservative sources. It's needless, and I think that's ultimately harmful to them, not to Ford.
Not that most people were paying much attention, this being July, but as of last week, Canada has a slew of new federal cabinet ministers. How interesting that fact is to you probably depends on whether you inhabit Ottawa's ecosystem. As the Wednesday shuffle drew near, the chattering class practically consumed itself, trading in gossip and snark and schadenfreude. But out there in the land, some of those cabinet appointments are as serious gets. Government oversees and regulates vast swaths of the economy. Having the right people at the top of the pyramid is literally crucial to our well-being. An example? Transport Canada. It's a vast ministry, both a regulator and dispenser of government funding. It regulates rail, air travel, trucking, and marine transport, to name just four vital sectors. It's no exaggeration to say that every one of Canada's 338 federal ridings has some sort of transportation issue. And these are tentative, fragile times. Our supply chains, which ensure our quality of life, have endured an unprecedented level of simultaneous attacks, severe weather events, foreign wars, the aftermath of a pandemic, labor disruptions, and manufacturing problems, to name several. Ensuring Canada's supply chains remain fluid and resilient, ensuring throughput, to use an industry term, is a massive task involving a long list of players, including our sponsor, CN. But it's Transport Canada, and ultimately the minister, who carries the stupendous responsibility of enabling it all. That's the system. A skilled minister makes all the difference. So all of that is to say, welcome, Minister Pablo Rodriguez. Your reputation precedes you. To paraphrase a popular song, an economy turns its lonely eyes to you. CN looks forward to an enriching, collaborative relationship with emphasis on collaborative. And now, there's work to be done. All right, you guys, there was a cabinet shuffle last week. Holy Christ, it was big. It was built to be big, and it was big. Pieces moving all over the place. There was a piece in the Star about it in the aftermath. I mean, because all of the actual shit's been discussed to death. But so this was kind of fun, this piece in the Star. Some Liberal MPs, many of whom spoke to the Star on condition they not be named, are perplexed and disgruntled by a cabinet Trudeau is touting as fresher and more energized governing team that is ready to tackle the country's economic woes. Among those MPs' top concerns are questions over who was snubbed, dropped, and added to cabinet at a time when the Liberals are lagging in national polls behind Pierre Poilievre's Conservatives. I'm disappointed, said one Liberal MP, who predicted some caucus members, themselves included, are reconsidering whether they want to run for re-election again. The choices seemed not to be based on hard work, talent, and commitment, the MP said. Another MP said assembling a strong front bench is something that won't happen until the Prime Minister's inner circle undergoes a transformation of its own, including the exit of Trudeau's longtime Chief of Staff, Katie Telford. We all know there's a tight circle around the PM. If you're going to convince Canadians that you're going to think differently and be different, then you need to have to make changes around that circle as well, the MP said. Now, with speculation about whether Trudeau can lead the Liberals to a fourth straight election victory, MPs who spoke with the Star still have not lost hope that it's possible. We've changed the face of government, one MP said. Now let's change the blood and guts of it. Okay, so the article mentions the polls, and this is an important context for the shuffle, because the Liberals appear to have fallen 8 to 10 points behind the Conservatives. Some polls have it at 10. Philippe Fournier at 338 says it's average of 8 behind the Conservatives from what was a 2 to 3 point gap not long ago. There's big trouble in these polls looming in both Ontario and Atlantic Canada. So, Corey, was this shuffle the big move the Liberals need to get back into contention?
Well, it's clearly what they were aiming for. Like, if you look at the ethnic diversity of those folks and the geography of those folks, they're trying to build a bit of a wall around the GTA and trying to stave off some inroads that are being made within those new Canadian communities and inroads into the region more generally. Like,
Hill Times has a good piece about this today, by the way. Read the Hill Times today. It's got a good piece about the political context of the appointments.
Yeah, but like I think that's sort of what they were aiming for. And they, clearly they, for all of the pre-spin around wanting to have a, stronger economic narrative, et cetera, as we've talked about before, they didn't really kind of do that. And the spin from the PMO folks talking about that didn't really match up very well with the actual quotes that the Trudeau was giving in his press conference afterwards, which I think was, hey, we're marching down the same road we were before. Like, there was no tweaking of the narrative in any substantial way that I could observe anyway. But like, look, what is true? They've buttressed support, elevated people in communities where they are at risk of losing votes to the Conservatives, whether it's the Tamil community, whether it's the Filipino community, and raise the profile of some of the people in their caucus and from those areas and those groups.
Scott, one of the things that I thought was interesting about this article was people talking at all. Right, this is so unusual in this government's record to have people talking like this. And the center seems to be losing some of its rock-hard control. I mean, you have articles like this that emerge now. I was very, erstwhile friends are now starting to distance themselves. I was very struck by the latest Mansbridge show where Chantal Hebert and Bruce Anderson just laid a savage beating on the government and this shuffle. Where's that all going, do you think?
Well, I do think that's super interesting. I may have a slightly different read of it than you do in terms of its importance. I think that in the aftermath of the election, those that are really close observers might be overcorrecting on that. They might be putting too much on that bet.
Do you remember though sometime between 2004 and 2006 when you could just feel the worm turn and the way everybody treated us changed a little bit?
For sure. And it's informed by that. I would say that this is small stakes. Now, you might say yes, but its presence indicates that perhaps they're on a trajectory that other leaders have experienced in the past, but they appeared to be invulnerable to for years and years. And maybe, but I guess my takeaway on it is a little more superficial. My fundamental takeaway is that this shuffle was really a swing and a miss, and that, the wide variety of efforts to contextualize it by the PMO failed to not only persuade media and observers and independent commentators, but obviously it's failed to persuade caucus. That's the first and most superficial takeaway I take from that, is that the own caucus doesn't buy this storyline. And you sort of see it moves from, we're strengthening our economic front bench. Well, that's just horseshit. We're putting our best communicators in place. Well, that didn't feel persuasive. And, so now they're retreating to like, well,
are you dissing Bill Blair? Like Bill
yeah,
Blair?
Exactly. Anyway, on
hold
and on.
Hold on. We'll get there, Corey.
So, but there's, and so now we're kind of left with it. Like the 3-4 days out sort of spin is all this stuff about, well, actually, if you take a look at it, it's a micro-targeting play. And it's like, okay, but I'm unpersuaded. Okay. I'm unpersuaded that
it's Pitfield's cabinet.
It is. And so that's what, so that's what it is, right? It's this micro-targeting play. And I'm like, well, do you really need those ministers and those portfolios of people that have never heard of and will not hear of in order to jam those Facebook ads? I don't think that one thing enables the other, and I don't buy it. I simply don't buy it. So, but you know, it's notable. They're starting to sling some arrows toward the prime minister's office. We see Katie being invoked, all of that sort of stuff. I just don't know. I think there will be some of that. I don't think that, you know, when people start posing these questions, that does this mean there's going to be disruptions and cracks in his caucus? Does this mean they're going to go after the PM? Oh, no, say others. They'll never go after the PM, but they will go behind at those beside the throne, like Katie and others. I'm not convinced. I think this is a little bitching and moaning, but I do think
it's a lonelier job now than it was before.
I think it's a tougher job. And I think that all of it. So I'm not prepared to sort of say, you know what, this is going to start to look like it did in our time and so on and so forth. I just don't know that that's just not the culture of this caucus. And I don't think that that's where it's going to end up. But I do think that this cabinet shuffle missed, like they presented it as big, but my slogan for it would be big, but not. Right? It's big, but not change. It's big, but not significant. It's big, but not consequential to electoral outcomes. I really don't think it is. And so to me, you say, okay, so you had this big shuffle where you move 30 people in one way or another, right? And it's not going to affect that concretizing 8 to 10 point lead, right direction, wrong direction, a bunch of these things. And you can say, look, the economy's starting to improve and we're getting over. I think this government's going to have to play some other cards in the future if it wants to affect the core fundamental dynamic that now presents it as it moves toward re-election. And I just think that when you play a card as big as a cabinet shuffle and it gets you as little as this did, it didn't even get you spin that would sustain itself through the first day of the cabinet shuffle. It doesn't fundamentally alter the direction of the government. It doesn't signal change. It doesn't do anything that's going to melt any of those perceptions. I just think that that's a miss. That's a big miss. So now you have to move to other cards. And what are they going to be? For a government that does not wish to change direction in any fashion and in any way, I just think they've got their work cut out for them, and they're going to have to come up with a plan. That's my fundamental argument. Didn't have to be the cabinet shuffle, didn't have to do everything, but it did nothing. So now they're going to have to come up with a plan to fix this, because this thing needs fixing, and that's just a fundamental reality, or they won't win re-election.
Jordan, I'm going to pick up there with you, because they're 2 years out, late in a long mandate now. They're down 10 points. We've seen this before. We've seen it every generation. We know what's going to happen. They're going to lose. They're going to lose the election. The only way you might possibly extend the mandate in historical terms, the only times a mandate has been extended in the last 100 years, is through a change of leadership. Right? And doesn't always work. Lots of times it doesn't work, but sometimes it has worked, and it's the only thing that has worked, right? That is not going to happen here by the looks of it. So wouldn't you have to, as a government, say, short of changing the leader, how can we demonstrate that we are change, that we are the change people are looking for right now, and that there's something different about us that they didn't see in us before? And there's nothing about this shuffle that does that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's unique, but I was incredibly struck by a little bit of what Scott said. The desire for the shuffle to be seen as big change while simultaneously changing absolutely nothing about the core message or messengers. And so, I mean, in that sense, I think it was doomed to fail from the outset. Although I had a laugh reading the Star story, because like that kind of liberal backbiting and bitching, like, this is the Liberal Party I know and love, you know? So I think that's actually the indications there that people are willing to speak out and complain to media, like, this is not good. And I think that what I was really struck by is in the Prime Minister's remarks when he came out right after the shuffle, it was almost like whoever had pre-spun the shuffle to journalists did not speak to whoever was writing his remarks or briefing him, because he could have delivered those remarks 2 weeks ago. There was absolutely no indication of a new direction. There was no indication that he himself was seeing anything differently. There was no even.
He blew the spin. He blew the framing right out of the gate. He blew the
Peter's podcast. Peter's podcast. You mentioned it, and Chantel. She made this comment, and I'm sorry. Yeah. I'll jump out in a second, Jordan. But she made this comment that it may have been his weakest press conference since he was prime minister, and I think she may be right. Like, it was astonishing because his message was, "This means nothing." What about Anand and Blair? Nothing. Nothing. Like, there was. So I mean it. It was absolutely incoherent.
Yeah.
Sorry.
And that actually, and I think, so obviously others have pointed to this, but the obvious thing is that there has been no change within the PMO. And there, and what really stood out to me was just the incoherence of the presentation of the shuffle. Like, there was, it was not a fully coordinated spin. There was no actual muscular attempt.
Why don't they make some changes in the PMO? Like, it doesn't have to be Telford, although that would be the biggest change possible. Yeah. But are you telling me you can't govern without Ben Chin? Like, if you replace Ben Chin with somebody else,
I think
you can't carry on? Like,
it seemed to me like this was a group of people who, as you guys know, when you start pulling at the cabinet thread and you start moving, it gets complicated really quickly. So I think, you know, the fact that some of these moves don't make a whole lot of sense and that you have to come up with some lines to spin them, that is to be expected. But what really, really hit me was there was almost no cohesive attempt to present this as something different. And if you want to come out and say that you're delivering change, you need to indicate what you're doing differently. And there was no attempt at that. And I think that if these guys don't find a way to somehow run against themselves a little bit, run as change from what they have or have not done in the past, they are just fucked. And this was, if I were liberal, this is, would not be an encouraging episode, because this is arguably one of the easiest cards that they have to play in terms of presenting change. They have now played it. It is done. It was a mishmash. It was poorly executed. And the takeaway, if anything, I think has shown Trudeau to be weaker. And I'm talking in particular, you know, around the leadership speculation that that motivated Anand's move, because moving her, being seen to demote her, a rising star who might be, someone who could replace the prime minister, and sidelining her, like this speaks to weakness all around.
Yeah, so, I don't know if that's true, but they didn't put out a more plausible explanation. Yeah,
it doesn't matter at this point whether or not it's true, because they've not succeeded in counterspinning on it. Although I will say she is doing valiant work out there on that, which should also be noted.
Well, it's true she is demoted, but, you know, like, look, where were there other bright spots in this? Like, I think getting rid of Mendocino was necessary. Like, he, you know, and that's, you know, a change that's clearly related to competence and performance. But I'm not sure that putting Bill Blair in a war in charge of defense, like, you know, he's a has-been. He is the ultimate has-been, I think, in terms of where he's coming from. And if you're trying to lead cultural change around issues of inappropriate sexual misconduct, et cetera, is the 68-year-old cop the guy that you want to put in?
Best known to the public for kettling protesters at the G20.
Well, but like, how many NDAs and things like that did he sign off on in his 10 years as the chief of police in Toronto? Probably a lot. You know, it's just absolutely, you know, mind blowing that you would put that guy in that position.
Hey, Corey, can I just clear one thing up with you, since you've been a ground organizer in ridings, etc. We mentioned this Hill Times article, and there's sort of two components to it, one of which is ethnic outreach. And I think it probably is true that having a Filipino minister means that you can network in the Filipino community more effectively. But none of this wins a riding. Do you agree with that? Like, nobody knows whether their member is a minister or not, especially in the latter time of a government with a portfolio that doesn't matter all that much. These things don't save ridings.
I don't think in and of themselves they do, but, you know, there are sizable new Canadian communities that can shift seats in a region. Like, if you've got no game with the South Asian community, good luck winning in Brampton. Like, you're just not going to. So, you know, there are some areas where I think it's more meaningful, but it's more in groupings of seats. And,
but the title of Minister of Diversity and Inclusion does not win you your riding.
No, it doesn't. And look, most MPs are no names in their riding, and they can be replaced by another no name. And you know, you're gonna win or lose based on the popularity of the leader of your party and the brand of your party. And that's just the truth. I know it hurts people's feelings in caucus to point this out to them, but the reality is most of them are completely replaceable by any other name. And you know, there's a handful of people who are maybe a former mayor. I'm thinking of back to Elsie Wayne days, and where like that can be a thing. You can have some people who are like that, who have just such a large profile as an individual in their community that they add something to it. But that's not the typical example of somebody who's an MP or running to be an MP. Usually it's somebody who was a lawyer or selling insurance or something like that, but that nobody in the community really has any clue who that person is prior to them getting into politics.
Hey, David, I want to respond to the question you put earlier, because I think it's a really interesting one, and it gets to this fundamental dynamic about the prime minister's office, the psychology, not just around this shuffle, but about where they're at, and ultimately what they are and are not willing to do, and what he is willing and not willing to do. So when you put the question, well, why not Ben Chin or whatever, if not Katie, then others, who knows, right? So or when Jordan says, well, it's not change, like, they need, there's no change in their message or their fundamental direction. Although those observations are correct. I think there's a couple things. One, I think that they may very well sit and, theatrically insist that they don't listen to this podcast because who gives a fuck what Scott Reed and David Hurley with musicians on their t-shirts say about us when we've won three elections in a row and we're on our path to winning a fourth, or at least being competitive to win a fourth, and they took a majority government to a minority and then lost. So who gives a fuck what they think?
So just stop there. You got to admit that's a strong rebuttal.
I do. It's why I wanted to give voice to it. Hey, we're doing it. You're fucking sitting around jacking off on the internet about it. So that speaks for itself. I think that's part of the answer. That's, ultimately, that doesn't mean that every decision you make is correct either. But I think the other thing is that, it's entirely okay for the government to have said, well, we don't want to change our core composition of most important ministers. And we don't want to change the prime minister's office, and we don't want to change our economic approach. We think that it's working. We think that this is a punishing time, and any government at any point is going to find that when inflation is up and growth is weakening and tough economic times, you're going to take a pound out of the government. But we think 2 years from now, we're going to be moving through that storm. And we think the people that have guided the prime minister have done pretty good in the past. And we're not just going to throw them overboard because a bunch of people on a podcast or anonymous in a newspaper are yelling for change. So I think that's their argument. I would just say this. There are laws of gravity. There are laws of political gravity. And the laws of political gravity are if 8 to 10% become cemented, that you're going to need a strategy. And, they could have another shuffle in a year. People say, well, they lose. They could have another shuffle in a year. They can make a move. They can make a play. But they're going to have to do something. They're going to have to do something. And maybe they don't need to change their economic direction. I continue to believe that the argument they made, which was we want to strengthen our ability to communicate our record and our plans going forward, I think that does need to be addressed. I don't think it has been addressed. There's going to have to be a change. They can't permit this structure to become set in concrete. And it feels like it's moving there. And that's a really bad thing. And what will happen is that you will make a change that will be too desperate, too late, and too, therefore, ineffectual. I know that Mulroney hadn't been in office for years and years and years, but one of the templates I looked to was 88. And that's because what they do in 88 One, they disqualified their opponent. Obviously, that's part of Trudeau's thinking, right? So they blew up Turner when Turner got some life on him, right? So that's going to be a key component. The second thing is they shifted away from being a referendum on a government that had proven to be unpopular, and they made it a referendum on something else. In that case, they made it around, you know, free trade. They managed to move GST off the agenda and made free trade. I think they may have to think about those kinds of things, about playing a big card, not about what our agenda has been or what our record has been, but rather trying to make it about moving forward as all elections ought to be, make it a referendum on a big motherfucking stirs the pudding issue going forward, something that drives discussion, and then try to cut the knees out from underneath Poilievre. I would look at that template and say, is there a path in there that allows you to sidestep these political laws of gravity? Because otherwise, if we just stay on the same track, I'm not convinced they'll be reelected.
So Scott, I just want to say, do you think that they can do that with a prime minister though? Because I was struck by how much he is a part of this communications problem, and he is really not bringing the energy of change at all to this. It seems like
I believe he's essential to it. Yeah. I actually think that guy can pick up the team on his back again. I really do. I know he's dented and bruised.
He can also probably run with any script. He doesn't need this script.
That's right. Okay. And I don't think there's, I don't think he's attached inherently to it.
So what's the disconnect? Is it all PMO then?
Well, it's because they said that it was going to be able to change, and they left themselves where there was a cognitive dissonance. This is change. Look how big this is. Big change. But when asked, there's no change to anything. So, you know, why Anita Anand out of defense? Oh, Anita Anand's done a good job. Hadjit did a good job. Blair will do a good job.
They wouldn't David even Hurley tell would us do what a good job. They wouldn't even tell us what needed doing better at Treasury Board.
No. So,
like, what was the need for her there?
But Trudeau has a better chance of winning more seats in Quebec than any other liberal. And he has a better chance of being able to perform under duress in front of the microphone during a campaign than any other liberal. So I know that typically you say, well, let's change leaders. I don't think there's a remedy in that approach.
Can I make a prediction? I think that that Freeland is not going to run in the next election. And I think that she is going to fuck them by doing so at the last minute, because she's going to take a job someplace else or do something else. And they will have, invested in this person as being the team leader in terms of their economic messaging. And I think she's going to abandon them. I think she's going to leave them before the end of this government. Cause that's just my guess. We had a similar thing happen with Christine Elliott going into the last election provincially, where you go around and you ask everybody in cabinet, are you going to run again? And are you sure you're sure? And then, 2 months before the campaign, oh, oops, surprise, our health minister has decided not to run again, which is, not the nicest thing in the world to do to your political party. But does anyone think that if Freeland were offered a job at the International Bank or at NATO or you name the place, that she wouldn't say yes and leave?
I think it would be really funny if she became the head of the OECD.
Yeah.
Anyway, enough about that. Speaking of the shuffle and policy, Jordan, let me come to you with this. If there was anywhere in the shuffle that people thought there might be a policy shift accompanied by the cabinet shift, it would be in housing, where they moved somebody who's considered to be one of their strongest, people say performer, but I would say minister, strongest ministers in all senses in Sean Fraser, to this portfolio, which all polls tell us is the right after the cost of living, the most important issue in the country to the most number of people. And when you look at young people, as Corey constantly reinforces to us, it's a huge issue. So far, nobody's really been able to. I think Poilievre's doing the best job at convincing people he cares about it, but I don't think anybody's been really able to own it yet, because I don't think anybody's convinced voters that they have something that looks like a solution to it or an answer. What do you expect out of the Liberals on housing now? And do you think that it's possible for them to emerge with a win on this file?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think it's difficult in the sense that there aren't really large, obvious policy solutions at the federal level. The distance of the federal government from where a lot of the operational decisions are being made at the municipal level presents big challenges politically. And the paradox is that a lot of policies that would be more popular don't make any economic sense, or could worsen some other issues. So I think it's a really tough nut to crack, and you're seeing each party throw a lot of different things at the wall to try to see what sticks out of that. And I would agree that I think Polyev has captured the emotions of the issue probably best, although I maintain that his Shaq comment could still come back to haunt him a little bit in terms of his own feel on the issue. But I listened to, so Fraser did, he did a pretty good interview.
Clip and save for a negative ad coming to a television station near you.
Yeah, I mean, it's so good, right? Yeah. Like, so Fraser did a pretty good interview on the House this weekend, if you have, or on Thursday, if you have a chance to listen to it. And his communication is just light years better than anyone who has handled the file previously, I would say. He actually has a narrative that speaks to people's desires around housing. He talks, you know, in a relatable way about the real challenges people are facing. He mostly avoids the use of the words housing accelerator fund. So these are all things in his favor. Are already on day two of the job. It's a big improvement. But you know, the same structural challenges are still there. So I think that the Liberals made a smart move in the sense that they've put a more relatable face, somebody who clearly has some ability to connect on this. But they haven't, you know, they're not yet able to find a policy solution that is a magic wand on this. So that leaves Fraser with, he needs to somehow be able to talk about, well, we're not going to continue to pour more money into broken systems, and we're going to be, you know, putting pressure on the municipalities. And all of this is ramping up, of course, to the fall, where we can expect to see the Prime Minister do something related to tied infrastructure funding direct to municipalities on housing. So I think that they're betting big on that announcement in the fall, that sort of top up to their housing plan as being their solution. So I'm not going to prejudge whether that gets there. I think it faces a lot of the same challenges politically that their previous solutions have, which is that it's big program itis. And then, of course, at a functional level, a lot of these programs are not actually being accessed by municipalities because of how they're designed. And even if they were, this is a really, really long-term solution, right? Like, the building, this housing is going to take a really long time. It's not actually helping people here. And one thing that I was really struck by in listening to Fraser and in general listening to how the PMO was positioning this, It's very sort of future homeowner centric, which is great. I think a lot of people aspire to be homeowners. But in the meantime, you've got 6 in 10 Canadians who aren't homeowners who have really given up on the idea of homeownership. And the proportion of Canadians who are renting is growing at more than twice the rate of homeowners. So there's a constituency there of current renters who are feeling a pinch, who feel that they are going to be renters for the foreseeable future, that so far has not found a place in their messaging. And I think that this is a group of people. It was very interesting to see in the Toronto mayoral race, like, Olivia Chow bet very big on renters, and it was quite successful for her.
What about rent control? Why isn't that top of the agenda right now?
Well, I mean, I think provincially it should be. Like, that's a provincial thing, and I think absolutely we're going to see that discussion come back.
I remember back from like 2016, 2017, my data, the polls through the goddamn roof. People love rent control. Yep. Maybe a bad economic policy, I don't know, but it's a polls like.
Well, and I mean, if you look at places like Ontario, there's a lot of holes in existing rent control, right? Where you get, you know, and we see one of the biggest things that for renters. Because I think sometimes you hear arguments around millennials saying, like, well, you know, people don't really want to own. They're happy renting for lifestyle reasons. But the reality is that renting right now is really insecure, right? You can get rent evicted anytime. And nobody wants to live like that. So there are also things that could be done to kind of address some of those pain points for people. But
I also think having an ownership culture is important, by the way.
Right. Well, and I mean, yeah, we can debate whether that's going to stick around in these circumstances, because I think it's increasingly unrealistic, but that may not change the fact that people want that, right? So it's a tricky soup of emotions for people to hit on and to connect with. I think that the policy fix is tough. I'm not sure anyone's doing a great job, but I would say that like early reviews on Fraser is that like day two, three into the job, I think he has put a better face on the existing policy for the Liberals than anybody has before, but we'll see. Like, it's going to really depend on how they carry off this announcement in the fall.
Corey, in some respects, it's kind of interesting, maybe ironic, if Alanis Morissette was writing the song, that Fraser got this job because this issue, housing, threatens to blow up the Canadian consensus over immigration.
I agree with you. I agree that's what the risk is. And I think for any politician in this space, talking about the problem is what you got to lead with. And you got to spend a lot of time talking about what the problem is before people are going to twig into, all right, I'll be with you on this solution or that solution. But fundamentally, this is not a complicated issue. We are growing as a country. Our population's growing considerably. If you're looking in Ontario, it's about 500,000 people a year that are coming in. So like every 2 years, we add the city of Mississauga to the GTA. Yeah. And we're building enough housing for, I don't know, Cornwall. Like, and this is the issue. And every year, the housing deficit gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And it's going to create huge friction points between different demographic groups, largely millennials and new Canadians. And I think at some point, some enterprising demagogue's going to come along and capitalize on that. And I think that's something that we should be really concerned about. But at the end of the day, we got to build more fucking houses. Like it is really very simple. And it's not about, you know, oh, well, we'll just, you know, build some for low-income people who will pre-qualify, who are, you know, people who support my political party, or, you know, like that is not going to get us there. Sorry, it's just completely inadequate. We need to build more condos. We need to build more detached housing. We need to build more income-targeted housing. We need more housing of every different sort, and we need it tomorrow. And that means that all of the fucking NIMBYism of people who say, oh, but I don't want a condo next to my house, or I don't want to, you know, I don't want to have like low rise buildings in my now detached house neighborhood. Like all of that stuff, people have got to, give up on. They have to walk away from that if we want to actually be successful. As this is about zoning. This is about needing more of everything. And what it butts up against is NIMBYism from people who already have a house.
Yeah, and I have to say, like, that. I think it's really tough though, Corey, because even if you look in Ontario, where Ford has pushed aside, frankly, I think far too many rules around development, and you know that's a different debate. But even with all that, like, Ontario is not going to meet their housing targets. So
yeah, well, but there are reasons why that are making this more difficult right now, and it's called interest rates being high. That depresses the market in terms of construction. You're seeing that across the board in the United States as well. But we need to be doing more of this. And I think, you know, if we want to talk about Ontario politics, like people like Bonnie Crombie, who really haven't gotten any housing built of any substantial amount, are going to get the shit kicked out of them. Because I think it's going to be a test.
And drive by, run at Bonnie Crombie, and just, but not. Yeah, don't get the impression they're worried about her. Don't get the impression that they're worried about her at all.
No, because he's got the same. And Ted Hsu also, right? Like, I mean,
yeah. And, I mean, I gotta say, if the response we didn't get the housing built is interest rates, like, good luck, right? Because this is the same problem.
So wait a second, I want to jump in here.
Like, what do you think the solution is? If we don't build more houses, you're not going to solve the fucking housing crisis. Like, right, it's that simple.
Corey, several years ago, John Webster. Several years ago, John Webster, who's Scott's and my friend and my personal housing expert, was on this show saying the feds can play a convening role. So there's too many layers of decision-making in here, and the feds are the only people that can cut through it. The feds should convene the provinces and the big cities and put Polyev has an idea for a stick, match it with a carrot, and get some national rules in place about how built things are going to get built in a timely fashion.
I think with all due respect, that's not how it works, right? Like these are provincial and municipal issues around zoning, and the federal government has no capacity to convene that meeting and no jurisdiction to do it. So, well, yeah, you can give more money, but like the amount of money would be unfathomable. And it's, and money is not what's missing, right? It's not, money is not what's missing. Authority to actually go and build the housing and labor to construct it is what's missing. And so, you know, we have a big deficit in terms of skilled trades in any area in construction. We have a huge deficit. We've got hundreds of thousands of jobs like that that are vacant right now. It's one of the reasons why we need more immigrants. But you know, it's a problem that's feeding upon itself, you know, in that sense. But you know, the federal government, you know, putting some more money on the table, yeah, sure, that'll be helpful, but I don't think it fundamentally changes much. You need to have authority to build more housing, and you know, and I don't think the federal government wants to do that, because I think they benefit from the environmental NIMBYism more often than they than not. They enjoy it. Like, why do you think they're against constructing new highways?
I'm going to take this in a different direction. All right. Sean Fraser's been made the Minister of Housing. It's almost the only thing about the shuffle that I thought that was sincerely noteworthy, and that I really genuinely admired about the shuffle. But if you're listening, Sean Fraser, I want you to sit closer. I want you to turn up the volume, and I want you to hear me. You are in grave danger. You are in grave, grave danger, my friend. Because people now are turning their heads to look at you, encouraged and pointed your way by the Prime Minister's office, and say, here in 1940, as London is bombed, all eyes look to you, sir. So you've got to do two things. And I really strenuously mean this, Minister. One, you've got to get out right away and you have to right size expectations for yourself. Do not let expectations run wild. There will be a lot of advice that says, get out there and just talk about this issue and how much it's going to be a priority. But you've got to right size those expectations. I think you've got to sort of craft a message about where you think things can be and should be and who benefits from that, say 3-4 years from now, and get a couple quick wins. What are you going to do in the immediate term? But I think you've got to be very careful about allowing expectations to rise and rise and rise when those things can't be met, because you don't want to be the political roadkill on this issue. You don't want to be, to use the analogy of the housing, you don't want to be the witch that's underneath it, like when color suddenly comes in to the Wizard of Oz. The second thing, and it's important from a policy perspective and from an issues management and expectation setting perspective, don't let finance and the Prime Minister's office run this file completely. Do not let them set it, because I think what's going on is, you know, I applaud the fact they put Sean Fraser in charge, and I applaud the fact that they twinned it with infrastructure and makes it real, like actually gives it girth as a ministry and a federal department. But we've all been hearing the signals around the infrastructure program and the technical changes, and Jordan was alluding to these. Don't let that alone be the play. Like, it's like, okay, I've been elected to be very tall and to speak very loudly and very much better than anybody else in the cabinet on this. But now everything that's going to matter is already set in train, and finance is going to drive it. Don't let fucking finance run this file. You've got to do more than that. And I do think there are things that the federal government can do. And I think that because I know the federal government has a bigger checkbook than anybody else. And I would say you drag that checkbook back and forth across the country and you create a series of incentives. And I like Webster's idea, but it really only matters if at the end of that meeting, you have so teased and titillated people with the prospect of big money that they will eliminate the barriers to building. So those are my two pieces of advice. Set expectations and don't let finance run this.
Okay. You know what? We're going to have to come back to this. We're going to have to come back to this because Gordon Pinson has other things to do, and he's run out of time. So, Mr. Pinson, can you ring in the Hey Yous for us?
Ladies and gentlemen, please return to your seats. The Hey Yous are about to begin.
All right, Jordan, what do you got?
My Hey You is going out to Minister Freeland. because a week ago, which seems like a lifetime, as always in politics, after we recorded last week, Minister Freeland put out a letter pushing back on Mayor Chao's request for more federal funding for Toronto's considerable little financial problem. The letter was...
Forward to New York City. Drop dead.
Yeah, exactly. So... Yeah, so Freeland's letter was weirdly combative, let's just say, off the top, and especially odd given that just 2 days later, the government was going to do a shuffle to protect seats in the GTA and in Toronto. And I think it was especially problematic given that if the federal government isn't going to be there to substantially assist Toronto with its truly unique financial situation and the burdens that it carries in terms of service delivery, people may start to wonder why you can swing a cat and hit a Liberal MP in Toronto and it doesn't seem to make any difference for the resources that the city gets, that those people in Ottawa are not pulling for the city in any meaningful way. They might start to come to that conclusion. And it's also weird because at the end of the day, the feds are going to have to deliver for Toronto. That is just a reality, a law of gravity. It will end up occurring. The minister should perhaps consider doing it proactively. Mm. So I hear you this week out to Minister Freeland.
Yeah, I know. Anecdotally, I noticed that people in Toronto are starting to notice that Toronto's a dump. Right?
Got some problems.
Anybody else got to hear you?
I'll do one. I guess the port workers and Seamus O'Regan. It's I am perplexed by this seemingly zombie-esque labor dispute at the ports, where every time we keep hearing there's a deal, then there's not a deal. Yeah, but I think this is, you know, something that affects so many different businesses. And when we're dealing with a period of high inflation, we don't need any additional supply chain disruptions, fucking up pricing and other people's businesses. It's time to get this thing sorted. I'm not close enough to understand why this is being so dicey, but it's time to move on and get this dealt with.
All right, Scott, I hope your hey you is about Conway Twitty.
No, but I'll always make ample reference to Conway Twitty. So a couple things. I've got a rare daily double for my hey you this week. It goes out in equal measure to both Pierre Poilievre and Chrystia Freeland. So there was a Twitter spat in the last 24 hours or so, or X Games, I guess we have to call it now. I don't know, whatever. But there was a fight. She scrummed in Prince Edward Island, and Pierre Poilievre took that scrum and carved it up into a piece of social media where he disingenuously and very inappropriately, in my view, because it's shitty, he cut it up and gave out a context, little quotes and clips and all this kind of stuff, and made her sound completely awful. That's not cool. Like, I know nobody gives a shit. I know everybody shrugs their shoulders, but it's not cool. It's not cool to invent a question and then place an answer that was from something else in a scrap of an answer. It's a dick move. Dick, 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 dick. And, you know, you guys won't stop, and all right, but it's no good. So strong condemnation on you for that. But I also want to condemn the minister for then replying to it with the full 11 and a half minutes of the clip. Why? Because the clip sucks.
Unfortunately, wasn't a lot better. It wasn't really a lot better.
It's not better. It's more honest.
The call is coming from inside
the
house.
But it's not reassuring. You're speaking of, you know, Conway Twitty. It's like literally like when she talks about street level, and this is the whole point around the shuffle, bread and butter economics and responding to that kind of stuff. It is like me performing karaoke. It's like me singing Conway Twitty, right? It's only make-believe. You know what that is? That sucks. I had to force myself to watch it.
I had to say to myself, it's my job to watch this. Like, I have to watch this.
So that's not a remedy to that. I think it's probably stupid to even engage and respond to him in that fashion. You're not being, it's not a good fist fight tactic, all that sort of stuff. But set aside that, it's actually places in display the challenge that is so overwhelming, and despite the massive cabinet shuffle, remains unaddressed. So
I like the backbencher who steps up to the mic and says to the reporter after she's finished her 11-minute answer, "So I think your question was X, and maybe the answer would be Y."
Just it's like, oh, terrible.
All right, my hey, use a quick double-barreled shout out to two fellas. First, Omar Al-Ghabra. Omar announced he wasn't running again, and he wasn't included in the cabinet, so he won't be running in the next election. I was present at Omar's decision to enter federal politics. I'm very proud of that association with Omar, and he's been a pillar of the Liberal Party for the last 20 years. So thanks for all your service, Omar. And to Mark Miller, I interviewed Mark Miller last week just before the shuffle for the Hurly Burly. And, you know, this is a policy area where there are a lot of different perspectives that one can have. And I'm not going to take those on, but I'm just going to say I defy you to find anybody who could have approached that job with more diligence, more humility, and more determination than Mark Miller did. I was thoroughly and utterly impressed with him as a human after talking to him in that interview. And so I'm kind of sorry to see he's leaving that job to a job that maybe requires less of those skills. I don't know. But in any event, Mark Miller, you did a great job, and thanks for talking to me last week. So those are my hey yous. I want to thank everybody who watched or listened today. Thank our presenting sponsor, TELUS, and our sponsor, CN Rail. The three of you, it was great to fucking see you again and have this chat. And come back and see us next week where there'll be more of the Curse of Politics. Till then, take care of yourselves.